good afternoon.
Yes.
So hopefully you're here for 30-30. So I'm Professor Rice. I'm not Ben Kott. Ben Kott will be teaching other days. So talking about 30-30. So I'm going to do logistics a little later. So please hold questions about logistics until later. Start by talking about what is this course about. So we're about layers of abstraction. In 2150, you started sort of story that we take something like C, and C gets converted to assembly. And you saw a little bit of the idea that we can convert assembly to machine code, and that's what our hardware is actually going to know how to interpret. We typically don't want to build hardware that looks for the letter A followed by the letter D followed by the letter D. We could do that. It's just very inconvenient and not particularly efficient, so that's not what our hardware is going to do. So we convert to this machine code format, and that machine code needs to run on some hardware. And you might say, well, okay, so you're just going to take out your transistors and your other components and you're going to wire them together, maybe for a processor under electron microscope. Well, that's not what we actually do to build processors. Just like you don't sit down and say, well, I want to write at my word processing program, so I'm going to start writing it in assembly. That's not what you say. We use some higher level abstraction, and we have that sort of higher level abstraction for hardware. So there are these things called broadly hardware design languages that are used to actually design these processors that process this machine code. And just like a language like C is going to compile down to assembly, our hardware design language is going to compile down to the actual schematic you can imagine making, the description of here are where you put the hardware components, here's how you wire them together. We're going to have something like a compiler which will do that. And just like for languages like C or C++ or Java, there's going to be varying levels of abstraction we're going to end up using in each of these. So why don't I start by talking about sort of our layers of abstraction. And I've shown you on this thing, this picture, what our choice for this class for the thing at that layer of abstraction we're going to use is. It doesn't mean it's the only thing. In fact, never is. So our high level language for this course, or higher level, because usually people don't say C is high level, is C. And we've made a choice to use C. We're not saying that C is a great language. We're not even saying that you should use C for any real code. Why are we using C? Well, one reason is that you kind of know it. So hopefully you took 2150 or something like it and saw C++ or something like it and vaguely remember that. And C is almost a subset of C++. And so it just mostly removes some features like classes, IO streams, new deletes. It turns out that you would think, like, given that the big thing about C is removing features from C++, that you could take C code and it's valid C++ code. This is less true than you would think. If you take a random piece of like open source software that's written in C, probably it will not compile with C++. Because there are some important differences, but none of them are likely to affect you going from knowing C++ and pointers in C++ to looking at C code and knowing what's going on. And, well, the goal of this class, as I said, isn't developing things in C. Like, we aren't using C because we think C is a good language for developing software. It's because we want to go down these layers of abstraction, that we are really talking about how does, the code and the hardware design language look. That's like a lot of what our class is going to be about, is what's the design at that level going to be. And C is helpful for thinking about that, because often we want to think about not like what is it at that level, but how does this correspond to programs I'm actually running? And C is sort of a nice substitute for assembly, that we can use C in place of assembly and ignore some details of assembly, like caring about what registers do we use or calling conventions and so on, but still get most of the idea across because there's a direct correspondence that for the most part you can take some C code and there's some obvious assembly code to generate, you know, like something like x plus equals y probably turns into an add instruction. And yeah, you don't know what the registers are or so on, but like that's a pretty direct correspondence. You can do the translation manually, and that's useful for thinking about it. And this doesn't work so well in something like Python, where x plus equals y, well, first we have to like do something different depending on whether x is a string or not. You know, that doesn't come up in C. And in general, we have a pretty direct mapping for all the things we would do in assembly to C code that lets us, you know, not have to deal with the ugliness of assembly all the time. And so this should help you think more about what the machine is doing without working in assembly all the time. Now, there's this direct correspondence that this nice manual translation that's straightforward, and you might say, yeah, and that's what the compiler does. Well, it's not. You would think the compiler just does the straightforward translation to assembly, but the compiler is under no obligation to say, use plus equals, that's an add instruction. The compiler can be clever. And modern compilers often are clever and will do things that are intuitive. We'll have some concrete examples of this probably next week. So they might do confusingly indirect things. We are not using C because we think C compilers generate this direct correspondence. We're using it because it allows us to reason about that correspondence, not because you actually expect that when you write C code, it directly turns into that assembly. Like, often it will, but the compiler is allowed to take shortcuts, and current compilers, when they think it will make your code faster, will do so. Even in cases where maybe it's, you know, not going to produce the results you expect. So that's why we're using C. And because we use C in this course, you need to have an environment where you can run C. You should have department accounts hopefully by the end of the week. I sent a list this morning. If you don't have something by this weekend, please email me so I can make sure that happens. There are instructions for logging into the department machines on the course website, which is linked off Colab. There are other options, so you can use Linux either natively or in a VM. Some assignments you can run natively on OS X or the Windows subsystem for Linux. We do not make guarantees that all assignments, especially the first one, will work this way. But for some assignments, you might be able to use OS X natively or Windows subsystem for Linux without problems. Generally, our suggested platform is the department machines. A lot of people end up using their laptops, but if you come to a TA and say, I can't get this working on my laptop, the TA's response is going to be, let's get you using the department machines, not let's spend 15 minutes debugging how to get something working on your laptop. So that's on C. So as I said, we're using C because it corresponds to assembly, and because our department machines use 64-bit x86, and because you've seen 64-bit x86 before, that's the assembly language we're going to use. We're going to use 64-bit x86 assembly, and in theory, you all know it because you took 2150. You all know x86 64 assembly. I know in practice that may be a little less than true. So we'll do a little bit of review of that over the next few classes. And sort of that's the next step. Now, in 2150, when you talked about machine code, you talked about machine code that was IBCM, this sort of very, very toyish machine code. And you might be expecting that, well, now we're going to use, since we're using x86 64 assembly, we should be using x86 64 machine code. And we aren't. Instead, we're using this thing called Y86. So this is our textbook's subset of x86-64. So we are going to talk about normal, full-fledged x86-64 assembly, because it's a useful skill. We'll have some assignments that use that. But as far as when we're talking about anything involving machine code, we're going to use this subset. And partly this is because we're going to have an assignment where you're going to build a processor, and x86-64 has like 2,000 instructions or something on that order, and you probably don't want to spend your time implementing 2,000 instructions, and we probably don't want to spend our time grading 2,000 instruction processor. So we're going to have a much smaller set. Also, the real x86-64 encoding is incredibly complicated and not for good reasons. So x86-64 was built on 32-bit x86, which was built on this 16-bit processor. And like they started out having four registers, and then they moved to eight for 32-bit x86 and some of the early 16-bit processors. Then they moved to 16 with 64-bit. And as they were doing this, they were like, but I want to keep the machine code essentially the same. And this means that the machine code does weird things, like say, we're going to put part of the name of the register in this byte and part in another byte, because it's going to be the same as it was when we only had eight registers, but we'll add the extra bit elsewhere. And other things like that, which are just needlessly confusing, and like we could talk about, but it's just not worth our time. So we're going to use our textbooks encoding, which is much simpler. It's not going to have any of those complications. It's still not going to be nearly as simple as IBCM, so we're going to have a variable length encoding, what our textbook uses. It's going to have more than one register, so you don't just have an accumulator. Now we have most of the x86 32-bit registers, 64-bit registers, sorry. We're going to have actual full conditional jumps, not just like less than. And the textbook keeps some of the stack manipulation instructions. Okay, so that's our machine code and why we're not using the real hardware machine code. You're welcome to look it up, but it's just not worth the complexity, and it's not complex for good reasons, for as far as we're concerned. It's just history, which that's not really something that's going to help you build processors or understand how processors work. Okay, so then we have this hardware design language. So we, in this class, have a custom-built hardware description language called HCLRS, which is based on the description language in our textbook. We've decided over several years that the language in our textbook was a little too inflexible, doesn't let you make as much choices as we'd like. So we have our own variation of it. We'll talk about that when we get there in the class. And it's similar to what's in our textbook. And that's what we're going to end up using. So this is broadly similar to some sort of things like VHDL and Verilog, which are sort of the real-world industrial things of this sort, but much more simplified. The biggest differences are because our hardware description language is for just this class. It doesn't support doing anything but making a Y86 processor. That's all it supports. So some features are hard-coded for that, like it's not useful for other things. And we also omit some details that you'd actually need to worry about if you wanted to actually build the hardware. Like in a real system, you want to make sure you could actually like lay out the chip, and you want to specify things like where things are and memories and such on. We're kind of glossing over a lot of those details because we just don't support that. We're just running it in simulation. But it is similar broadly to what you would use to build a real processor. There's just extra details tacked on because you'd be using a language that supports building all sorts of processors, not just our instruction set, and you'd be dealing with the complexity of making it actually map to real hardware and the extra steps involved and things you need to specify that we just don't care about. But what the hardware description language does is that in the hardware description language, we're going to be able to specify, something like x plus y as an operation, and have the hardware description language figure out where do I get the hardware to do an add. So in this class, we're never going to deal with how do I add two binary numbers in hardware. We're just going to say someone provides, you know, the HCL provides the adder. That we don't have to figure out how do I build an adder out of transistors and wires. We're just going to use a plus operation. We're going to have that type of level of abstraction. We're not going to figure out how do I make a memory. We're just going to use a memory, and that's going to be figured out for us. And this would be your typical experience with one of the commercial things, is that you wouldn't just build an adder every time you need it, specify what it looks like as far as transistors. You're just going to say, I want to add two numbers. You figure out how to wire that up. And that's sort of the advantage of having this abstraction. And in this class, we are never going to talk about how do you build adders or how do you build registers. That's a different class if you want to learn about that. We're just going to say, someone's done that for us, and all we care about is how do you use them, use the components they've already built. So any questions about hardware design languages? Yeah?
What does HCL stand for?
Hardware control language, I think. It's probably in our textbook.
Okay.
And I copied it from our textbook. I probably should know because I wrote HCLRS. Based on what our textbook did. Yeah, I think it's hardware control language. Other questions? Okay. So, a lot of what our course is doing, you know, the first part is broadly going to be, we're going to go from this high level, work our way down, and talk about how do we build a processor, and then how do we build a faster processor. Now, you might say, well, I'm never going to build processors. I don't care about your class. Why should I learn this stuff besides passing your exams? So there are other reasons you might care about this class. So one is that understanding how hardware works is going to help you do things in when you're programming normally. So one thing we're going to talk a bunch about, because we're going to talk about building not just hardware that implements our particular machine code, but hardware which does so efficiently, is program performance. And you might say, well, I already know what assembly looks like, so I just write better assembly and I get better program performance. Isn't that all I really need to care about? And hardware doesn't work that way. So you'd have this naive model that each instruction takes a certain amount of time. If I have less instructions, that it's going to take less time. And yeah, the number of instructions matters, and like if you have minimal information is probably the fastest way to guess how fast your program is going to be, how many instructions it's going to run. But there are lots of other factors which can be pretty significant. And there are two big things that hardware does, both of which we'll talk about in the last half of this course or so, that have a big effect on program performance, and that, more importantly, they don't just make your program faster, but they make your program faster in certain ways that you can have your program take advantage of or not. So these two things are parallelism and caching. So fast hardware is parallel. If we have an adder and let's say, you know, if we have, say, two adders in our hardware, if we need to have two adders for some reason, we can use them both at the same time. In the hardware, we're not restricted to doing one thing at a time. As long as we have two pieces of hardware, they act independently. I guess as a more easy to see example of why we have two things, if we like have an adder and a multiplier, and they're different things, we can use them both at the same time, and your program will run faster if you can make it so that you can take advantage of that, if your processor has a separate adder and multiplier. So we'll talk about taking advantage of this parallel hardware. That when we make our processors faster, one way we do it is by making sure that we can do different things on our different components rather than only using this one adder, even though we have a whole bunch of other hardware that could do other things in the program. So one thing the hardware will try to do is look for things in your program that it can run right now and try to use that. And as a programmer, if you know that the hardware is doing this, you can structure your program so there's always lots of work to do, so you get the most out of all the hardware that's been put in the processor. And if you don't structure your program in that way, then yeah, you have this extra multiplier that's doing nothing most of the time. Even if you have lots of multiplications, you can structure your program so it's just not usable because like you need to wait for ads to finish first or something like that. So another big factor is caching. So our sort of naive model, and we'll talk about this more later today, is that we have our CPU, and it's connected to memory. This is sort of the model you probably remember with IBCM, sort of that you had a CPU with a register and a register and a program counter and talk to memory. But this is not actually how memory works. In practice, we have, so our CPU has a bunch of registers, and we also don't talk to memory directly, we talk to a cache, which talks to memory. And this cache here is fast, and this memory is slow. And when the CPU asks the cache for something, if it doesn't have it, it goes to memory. And that means that if you're asking the cache for things it doesn't have all the time, then your program's going to be much slower. And the question might be, well, what's in this cache? And the answer is, you don't choose it explicitly, but it's going to be things that were recently accessed. The cache, the policy, and we'll talk about why later in the semester, is going to be that the cache holds things that have been accessed recently. So if you can take advantage of what's going to be in that fast memory and make sure that most of the time when you ask for things, they're in there, your program will run a lot faster. And this is something that you can do deliberately when you're making a program. You can structure your program so you reuse things that were used recently, things that will be in the small, much faster memory, so you don't spend a lot of time going to this slow, big memory that's our, you know, main memory. And from an assembly perspective, this is kind of invisible, that the instructions which access this cache is a, you know, just a move, and the instructions which access this memory is just a move. And the only difference is how recently has the thing we're moving from been accessed before. So it's something where you need to think about what's the hardware doing beneath the assembly level to know what's going on. And the same thing is going to be true with parallelism, that we're going to write a normal add and multiply instruction to use this adder and multiplier, and you need to know about the hardware to think about, can these two things happen at the same time or not? It's not going to be something that's exposed at the assembly level. So any questions about either of these sort of general patterns we're going to see throughout the semester? Parallelism and caching. Yeah?
So just to clarify, there is a trade-off, in essence, between how much memory it carries and the speed that it's accessed?
So the question is, for caching, is there a trade-off between size of memory and speed of access? Yes. And this is a physical limitation, that if something is physically smaller, we can send a signal anywhere in it faster. Therefore, it's faster to access things. But if it's physically smaller, it can hold less data. So like that's one of the big reasons that this is sort of a fundamental thing that's going to happen. There's also other issues we'll talk about when we get to caching, probably, about there's different things you can build memory out of. And there's some technologies which are less space efficient, but faster. Like, by less space efficient, I mean you can fit less bits per square millimeter, but they're faster to access. And that's often what we'll use for the small memory. It might not be physically smaller than per bit, but it will be faster. Other questions?
This may be a really stupid question, But when I picture a computer, I picture it as like squares and rectangles inside, right? Why don't we build it as like a circle where like the CPU is in the center and then the caches are all around it, really close?
So the question is, why isn't there physical, so why aren't we tiling things to take advantage of this? So the, for the most part, the distance is not the factor. It's the it's not a big factor so much as like when we have lots of circuits to go through, and we have to like filter out the signals from a whole like a big array of things and filter it to one thing, for example. Like that's where the cost is. Most of the cost is coming from. I think this is not really my area. I don't do hardware design like at that level, but from a high level, like. Does matter. Also, we do some of that, just not in a way which is visible. So, just skipping ahead. So this is a picture of a processor die photo here. These are the caches. And they are physically next to, these are the cache. So this is a cache that I have here. And this is these are caches, smaller caches in front of that. So they are, and here is where the computation gets done. Like, so they actually are co-located on the chips like that. Like, actually, like right next to each other to make the distances small. So we do that in some cases. It's just like, this is within a chip. So that's in your physical computer that's covered typically by a plastic, you know, so it just looks like a box. But that in that box, we often do that sort of design you're talking about.
But so we couldn't get more efficiency by just putting more on the other three sides.
Yes, so that doesn't really help substantially.
Okay.
You might get more efficient. I don't know what the details are and how much that would help. I don't think that's my understanding is that's not a big help as far as efficiency goes. Mm-hmm. All right, we were here. So the main limitation is, I believe, just that you have so many bits to filter down to one thing. So you have an array of a certain size that you need to take one line from. And I think that's where most of the cost comes from. But as I said, it's not my area. Okay. So these are the big things hardware does. So another thing that we're going to touch on, including probably later today, is what compilers are and do. So you've seen compilers. You know that they translate things to assembly. We also are going to care about other steps of like how do they produce an actual executable. So there's some extra steps we haven't talked about where the assembly file doesn't provide all the information we need. And sort of what's in that actual executable that lets us run it. So those are things we're going to go over. And this might help you understand what the linker does more, which will help you understand compiler errors better. So that's a practical skill. Certainly things that are useful if you want to make compilers, knowing what the compiler is actually doing. And for debugging applications, knowing how the executable is put together. You know, as far as why do things get put in particular memory addresses is going to make that hopefully easier in some cases. And another thing we'll go over is in addition to sort of how do we build a processor for as far as just like running code, running it fast, we also care about running multiple programs together and supporting operating systems. And it turns out that we have a lot of hardware which exists in a processor to make the operating system work. That we technically could have an operating system which doesn't have any special sort of hardware support, but that's really inconvenient. So there's going to be hardware built to let us run multiple programs on one machine at a time that's going to help the operating system do that. And we're going to talk about what that looks like. And understanding that better lets you understand things like, well, what's a segmentation fault? How does that work? You know, how am I interacting with other programs? What's really going on? So if something goes wrong in that, what should I look for? How do I understand that? And obviously, if you end up writing an operating system, it's really important to know what does the hardware give me that lets me do this efficiently. So any questions about any of this? Okay, so those are things that I hope it's useful. I know I will still get some feedback on the course evals at the end of the semester that this course is completely useless and should be dropped from the required CS curriculum, but I tried. And I really do think we do some useful things here. So, on to a completely different topic, which is powers of two. So it turns out that because we're dealing with like storage, we're going to deal with powers of two a lot. So there's two things I'd like to do here. So I have a table of powers of two. So 2 to the 0 is 1, 2 to the 2 is 2, 2 to the 1 is 2, 2 to the 2 is 4, 2 to the 8 is 256, and 2 to the 10 is about 1,000, 1,024. And in this class, we're often going to use K to mean kilo, and we always mean the power of two. Always, always, always in this class. Sometimes you'll see some people use KI for kibobyte. That's when they really care about me saying, I mean 2 to the 10, not 1,000. That's unambiguous, but in this class, we'll use either one. We always mean the power of two. We have no reason to ever use 1,000. So we're always going to use this as a power of two. Similarly, if we take 2 to the 10 squared, which is 2 to the 20, we get about 1,000,000, and we're going to call that M for, or mega. And that always means 2 to the 20 in this class. And 2 to the 30 is G for giga, and 2 to the 40 is T for tera. And we probably won't go higher than that because it's hard to find machines with a petabyte of memory or storage out there that we're likely to care about. So another thing to note is that if we have, say, 2 to the 12 here, that if you remember doing math with powers, that this is 2 to the 10 plus 2, which is the same as 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 2, which is the same as k times 4, or 4k. And this sure is a useful conversion to do rather than dealing with these decimal numbers. And it's something we'd like you to be able to do because often we'll have to, especially in the latter half of the semester, when we're talking about caches, deal with power of two sizes and dividing them and comparing them. And it really is handy to do that in this sort of shorthand way, rather than working up 1,024 times 2 and like saying, oh, I need to divide, you know, 32768 divided by 4096. Like, please don't do that on an exam. You spend so much time, like, this, figure out what the powers of two are and work from that. So because of that, let's try some exercises. So here, 2 to the 35, what's that? I want this in a format like you saw here. I wrote 4k for 2 to the 12. I want the same idea for these, and I'll give you a minute or so to work through these. Thank you. mention that. So who needs more time? Okay, so I'll go through these quickly. So 2 to the 35 is equal to 2 to the 30 times 2 to the 5. This is usually the way I like doing it. You'll note that it's always the first decimal digit, so you can actually sort of do this by eye if you have what 2 to the 5th is memorized. If you don't have what 2 to the 5th is memorized, 2 to the 0 is 1, therefore 2 to the 1 is 2, 2 to the 2 is 4. I just keep multiplying by 2, 4 times 2 is 8, that's 2 to the 3. 16, 32 is 2 to the 5th. So this is 2 to the 30th times 32, which is going to be 32g. Because remember from before, we had 2 to the 10th was k, then m for 20, and then g for 30. For 2 to the 20th, we again have the first, we have it 2 to the 20, the 1, so this ends up being m from 2 to the 20, and 2 to the 1, so this ends up being 2m. So questions so far? Okay, for 2 to the 9th, I would usually write 512. Sometimes people write 1/2k. We don't care what you do for the most part, but whatever is convenient. And for the 4th, remember that because we have a 1 here, this is going to be k, some number k. This is 2 to the 4th k, which is 16k. Just if you use the trick of the first decimal digit, just don't do it for 2 to the 9th. You don't say, what's 9? That's after t. No, no, there's a 0. 0, 9 if you write those two digits. Okay, so questions? We did here. Okay. And you can also go in the other direction. So figure out the power of 2. So 2 to the blank. Who needs more time? Okay. So the way I go through this is we take, so 16, and we remember, just get our table, k is 2 to the 10, m is 2 to the 20, g is 2 to the 30, t is, or tera is 2 to the 40. Do the multiplication, and then I need to figure out that 16, oh, that's 2 to the 4. If I didn't have that memorized, I could say 2 to the 0 is 1 and just work that out, which is generally less error prone than trying to, like, compute 16 times 2 to the 30 and then work out what power of 2 that is from there. And then we take 30 plus 4 is 2 to the 34. And similarly, for the next one, we have 128 times 2 to the 10. 128 happens to be 2 to the 7. So that's 10 plus 7, or 17. Again, we have this pattern that the first digit is from the suffix of the power of 2. So you can often do this in your head if you have used the powers of 2 enough to memorize them. If not, you can just work out. We have 1, 2, 4, 4, 8, and so on, and just work that out and easily do this calculations early. So, and the handy thing about this is that if you want to figure out how many times does 4m fit in 16g, well, now we can do 2 to the 22 over 2 to the 34. If you remember how powers work, that's actually a computation we can do. And boy, I want to see that in an exam and not, 1, 6, 7, bye. And if that. Even though you probably can get the right answer the second way, it's not a good idea. Okay, so that's our interlude on powers of 2. So I mentioned at the beginning I would talk about logistics. I've talked a little about logistics of a C environment. Let's talk more generally about course logistics. So I'm obviously not Professor Venkat, I'm Professor Rice. Venkat and I will be splitting lectures. So most of the lectures in the first half, up to exam 1-ish, will be me. Most of the lectures in the second half will be Venkat, is the current plan. It should be the same lecture in either section, roughly, because we're sharing labs. We don't think it would be very nice for you to have completely different lectures and then go to the same lab and have the same assignments. So we're making sure both sections get the same lectures. And I mentioned labs. So labs. There are labs which are assigned weekly. The grading on labs is generally going to be, did you make reasonable progress? Will there be something the lab tells you to do? If you do that, you should definitely, if you do that successfully, you should definitely get full credit. And you'll probably get full credit for doing slightly less than that, and probably get partial credit for reasonable attempts that don't get very close. There are homework assignments. For the most part, there's going to be a lab followed by a homework. In some cases, there's going to be a very direct correspondence. Like some of our homeworks are like, start with your lab solution. And some of our homeworks, it's going to be a little less direct. It's where the homework is going to use the same sort of concepts you went over in the lab. But generally, the idea is the lab is going to be a place where you can work, you can collaborate, you can ask TAs, you can figure out the topic, and in the homework you'll actually need to do something with it. And the idea is that the lab is a friendly place to learn that, and the homework is going to be due before the next lab, so at noon lab day, noon because that's before the first lab time. Mostly there may be some exceptions, we'll talk about them when we get there, and are to be completed individually. So homework assignments, you may not work with other people. You may certainly not work with friends on the internet who aren't in this class, and so on. We also have some exams. They are on the schedule. If you can't make them, we want to know soon. Because definitely not after any of the exams. So we also have quizzes. So in the early part of the course, which I'm leading, we'll have weekly pre and post quizzes starting around the add deadline. So that's not this week or before next week. We'll talk about them more when we get there. The pre-quizzes will be based on readings. So yes, that means you probably should have access to our textbook. The assignments we do for processor design are tightly tied to our textbook, so I strongly recommend being able to refer to it. It's really helpful, and you probably should look at it. Probably a lot of students who had trouble on that assignment would have done better if they looked at their textbook. We'll have post quizzes based on lecture. Venkat wants to do some sort of problem sets to replace the quizzes, and some of them might be integrated with the homework instead of separate. or be a separate submission that's not like the quizzes are. So the quizzes will have an electronic quiz system. For the problem sets, we may need to do them on paper. We'll talk about that later when it comes up. Just letting you know now. So I mentioned we have labs and homeworks. Labs and homeworks are not quite synchronized with lectures. I know this is a problem with this course. The main issue is we need to cover material before you need it. And we have like a long sequence of homework assignments for processor design, and we can't really get to that until we explain the hardware description language and how like you build processors. So there's some prereqs to homework, so there'll be a little of a disconnect. We've tried to make this not so bad, but just be aware that that's gonna happen. So attendance. I strongly recommend attending lecture. But I record my lectures. This is a voice recorder. I should get a screen capture. On days where I don't have some technical issue, there will be a recording posted, audio, and the copy of the screen, which is why I have a way of writing on that screen and not on this chalkboard. The recording of the lecture is intended to help your review. It is not intended as a substitute for attending lecture. I understand that some students use it that way. I'm not going to stop you from doing that. I would advise you that there are not many students that works well for. There may be a few, but most students, it is not a good substitute. And we have problems like not actually paying attention to the lecture recording, or not actually viewing the lecture recordings. You promise yourself you'd view the lecture recordings, or having questions that you can't get answered from a recording because you weren't here. So I advise attending, but I'm not going to stop you from attending, stop you from not attending lecture. You're adults, you can figure it out. For labs have, usually will have electronic submission. We may have some exceptions, but for definitely almost always electronic submission that you can do remotely. If you can submit electronically and remotely, we aren't gonna check whether you're at lab. We also generally aren't going to check whether you're at the lab you're actually signed up for, except that if the lab is really busy, obviously people who are actually registered for that lab get priority. And we expect you to be able to, should we want to do something in lab, to actually attend your registered lab time. But we aren't going to enforce it unless we have a reason to. And if the lab is submitted electronically remotely, we don't really have a reason to care. Like the purpose of having a lab is that you have time, you can get help, you can work with other people. We hope you take advantage of that. But if you think that's not for you, we're not going to stop you. Okay, so questions about attendance or other logistics I just went over? Yes?
What's the textbook?
This is the textbook, Computer Systems, A Programmer's Perspective, 3rd edition by Brian and O'Halloran. There is also a paperback version intended for the Indian subcontinent that is cheaper and has the same stuff. You can use that if you're asking. It's a lot cheaper if you find it. But this is the textbook. It's on the course website, which is on Colab, and should be, the bookstore should know about it, though maybe they only know about it for the section I'm registered with. But.
Is it online?
Not freely. There are, yeah.
So are the labs due at the end of the last lab?
So the question is, when are the labs due? The labs are due, oh right, that's on the next slide, so sorry. The labs are due on the lab day, generally. Generally, if it's electronic submission, it's gonna be due by about midnight of the lab day. If we have paper submission, obviously, it's going to be due in person. And we have a late policy, which is where I would address that. So if you have exceptional circumstances for late policy, contact us. For homeworks, they're due before the lab. The intention is that you finish the lab before you start the homework, and that you finish the homework before you start the next lab, just because we don't want you working on the homework in the lab, next lab. Like it's not nice for us. But yeah, the labs are due on the lab day. So I guess I should go on to late policy. Are there other things I should talk about before that? Yeah.
Do we have lab this week?
Do we have lab this week? No, there is no lab this week. The lab will not be staffed. You can go there, it will be very quiet. Right. So late policy for homeworks. Between 0 and 48 hours late, we will subtract 10%. It doesn't matter where in that window you are, it is minus 10%. Between 48 and 72 hours late, we'll subtract 15%. If you're beyond that, we will tell you how you did, but you will not get credit for it. For quizzes and labs, generally, we will not accept late submissions. For labs, the issue is when we have labs which build where the homework builds on it, like where we say start with your lab solution, we might release a sample lab solution. And obviously, if we do that, we can't really accept lab submissions after giving everyone the solution. And we don't want to delay that until for 3 days. We want you to be able to start the homework right away. For quizzes, our quiz tool will generally show you the answers right afterwards, so you can review the top material, ask me in lecture about them, and that means that we can't let you take them late because the answers are revealed and I might even talk about them in class. So we generally won't do that. If you can't do, if you have illness or some special circumstance, our usual solution for quizzes will be to drop them. For the labs, we might take you on your honor that you did it or do some other exemption. We can do something, but generally, we won't accept late submissions. Yes? Can we use what the what answers? If we supply you with a lab answer, the cases where you can do this, the homework write-up will supply will link to a released lab answer. Otherwise, we don't want you to do it. But if we're allowing it, we'll say like you should. It will say something like use your your seek lab solution, or if you didn't finish it here is a example solution, something like that.
Yeah. Are the quizzes in class or like before?
So the question is when are the quizzes? The quizzes, I will go over this when we get closer. We have an online tool there to be taken before. Assuming I don't change things, it's going to be 90-minute time limit. Generally, it's like 4 multiple choice or questions in 90 minutes, which should be enough time, with adjustments if you have SDEC accommodations. So it's not intended to be time pressure. The main purpose of the time limit is for the pre-quizzes to encourage you to read before starting the quiz, rather than deciding to open up the quiz and deciding what do I actually need to read, being less of a good strategy. So are there questions? Okay. Also, we all have TAs. We should have a lot of office hours. Hopefully, we'll see. Like, obviously, we also have a lot of students, so maybe it won't be, should be a lot, enough. I'm not sure if it's plenty. We'll have office hours. They will start next week after the lab. I will post my office hour time sometime later this week when I figure out what meetings I need to schedule around. I generally will probably try to hold like 6 office hours a week, though I also teach another class, so. That, and the TAs will hold office hours, and they should be spread out throughout the week. You should encourage you to use them if you need help. I encourage you to especially try to use them on days which aren't the day before the homework is due. Because you will get better help on those days, typically, and also less stressful. So that's that. And just as a reminder, please have a C environment working before the lab next week. Some the department account's working. You should get your email with department account information by the end of this week. If you don't, email me by this weekend or something like that, so I can either on Monday make sure to get the IT people to create an account for you, especially if you join the class late or something. Oh, I guess I would note, in this section has open seats, so you're likely to be on the wait list, but if you are on the wait list because your lab is full, I would note that at last check, I didn't check recently, for instance this morning, the 630 lab has open seats, and there is a functionality on SIS called edit class, which allows you to change the lab section you are registered for without unregistering for a lecture section. So do that. I am not going to permit you into a lab unless you can show me that you cannot register for one of the labs that are open without like dropping a class you have a good reason to take or something like that. And I think that's very unlikely for the 630 lab. There aren't many classes that late. There might be other circumstances, but talk to me soon. Don't assume that spaces will open up even though they might. Okay, so any other logistics questions? Okay, so last topic we're gonna go over. So I talked about, we have, our processors and memory. So we have here a processor, which conceptually, sort of our notion of how our machine work from IBCM in 2150, is that our processor, we have in here, we have some registers and a PC, and our machine sends things to memory on what we'll call a bus, that's connected to memory, where you send an address and either get some data back from the memory or send some data to the memory. And this is what our processor does. So its operation is that when we want to execute an instruction, we first send the PC and get back the machine code. And then if the instruction accesses memory, we like send the address, the instruction reads, and get back the data, or maybe we also send the data to write, and then we send the next PC to read and do the process again. And that's what our processor does. So is there anything I'm missing here that we would expect in a computer? So I have a processor, some memory, yeah.
How does it take inputs?
So we need inputs, yeah. So we're missing a way of taking in actual input. So this is a computer. It computes things based on what's in memory, but that's not very useful if we can't choose what's computed. So in practice, we're likely to have a setup where I've drawn it this way. There's actually a variety of ways of architecting this, and we're not going to talk about the details of that. But conceptually, one way of allowing us to take input is we still have the same interface for the processor, that we have this bus that it's connected to, where it sends addresses and gets back data or sends data. But instead of that always going to memory, now that can either go to memory or our I/O devices. And we just have some piece of hardware in the middle which decides which it goes to, which in this picture I've labeled as I/O bridge. And so the idea is when we're running our normal instruction, we'll send our program counter, the memory will send back our machine code, and then we'll, based on if this is a push instruction, we'll send back a, we'll send a, the stack address, so we'll send like 0x, whatever the stack address is, plus the RBP value to the memory will store it, and then we'll send the next program counter, do the next instruction, and if it's another push, we'll send another thing to the stack at a different address. If it's accessing an I/O device, we'll send something for that, and so on. And when we want to do I/O, we do the same process, rather than generating an address that memory is going to interpret, we'll generate an address that this I/O bridge will know, oh, that means the keyboard, there you go. And we'll just have some convention that set up in advance about where's the keyboard. And this is a way we can have our processor do I/O. and then we can send back the keystroke and get it back just like a memory access as far as the physical interface of the processor. So this is sort of a high-level view of what our processor is and what our memory is as far as how it communicates with the processor. So any questions on from this? Okay, so let's talk about what memory is. I talked about the interface for memory, that we send addresses, get back data, or send addresses and data, and store data. But what is memory actually? And as far as we're concerned in this class, memory is an array of bytes. In this case, I'm showing a 32-bit memory. We're dealing with 64-bit x86, so we're going to have something bigger than that. So each of these cells is 8 bits, and the meaning of them depends on how the CPU accesses it. So if we're accessing a piece of memory because it's the program counter, well, it must be machine code. That's what the processor is going to assume it is. It's going to interpret it as machine code. If we're accessing a piece of memory because it's an operand to an add instruction, it must be a number, an integer. We're going to interpret it that way. That's how we decide what's in memory. There's no labels here. It's just bytes. We don't know inherently. We decide how to treat it based on what instruction the processor is running and why it decided to access the memory there. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
Does that mean memory for different purposes is in different locations physically?
So the question is memory for different purposes in different locations physically? We will, for a lot of reasons, we'll not talking yet about where things are physically, and it ends up being there's a lot of factors that go into that. But we'll choose different addresses for different types of memory, definitely. So in the sense of that one way we'll know what memory is for is because we chose certain addresses for memory where we put machine code versus not. But that's not something the processor did, that's something the programmer writing on the processor did. Does that answer the question? Okay. So I've drawn memory in one way here, and I could also draw it in this way. So on the left side, I have the address with the highest number at the top of the page. On the right side, I have the address with the lowest number on the top of the page. And these are the same values in memory. I did not change the value contents of memory by drawing it differently. So I'm mentioning this for our next issue, which is endianness. So we're going to need to deal with endianness because, well, we access values which aren't just one byte, and we need to interpret them. So for example, I have my same contents of memory here. And let's say I'm running this C++ code. Let's say I'm running on a department machine. And on the department machine, the this is going to be a 32-bit, that's 4-byte value. That's an int. It's going to be that size. So we're taking the address 4200. So that points to here, but we want 4 bytes, and we're printing it out. And we need to say the question of what value do we get, given that this is our array of bytes. So the first thing we need to decide is, well, I need 4 bytes of data, and that pointer just specifies one of them. Which other ones do I choose? And what we will always, always do is take the numerically next ones. So we're going to take 42000, then add one. Note that it's the same things, even if I was drawing memory in the other way, flipped over, still the same numbers. If I was drawing it right to left, still the same numbers. That's our rule, that the pointer is the numerically least byte of the value. So now we've chosen these 4 bytes, and we need to turn this into one number. And there are two logical choices for this. So one choice is we can say that the byte the pointer specifies is the byte which is least significant, the one which has the least effect on the value. And that means if we write it out in hex, it goes in our standard English order in the rightmost spot. Or we can say it has the most significant value, in which case it goes in the leftmost spot in our English order. And these are two choices. We've seen both of them made. The first one is called little endian. The least significant byte is the one with the lowest address. The other one's called big endian. The most significant byte has the lowest address. So the way I like remembering this is all about what the lowest address means, which is the one the pointer points to. If it's big endian, it's the big part of the value we care about, the one which has the biggest effect on the number. If it's little endian, it's the little part, the one which has the smallest effect on the number. That's the way I like remembering it. And in this class, we will almost always use little endian because x86 uses little endian. So any questions about endianness? Okay, so now that we know about memory, let's talk about programs in memory. So there's some things I'd like to point out here. So this is the typical layout of programs in memory on 64-bit Linux. One question we'll answer later is, wait, what if I have multiple programs? How does this work? We'll talk about that later in the semester. But what Linux does is we decide that we're going to put the stack up here on x86. This will come up a bunch of times. The stack grows down, which means the top of the stack, because we're naming things based on the data structure, is at the lowest address. Yes, that's confusing. I'm sorry, but that's how it is. So the stack grows down. And then we have other memory. So we have our heap, which is where malloc new stuff goes. And then we have our writable data. This is global variables. And we have our coding constants, which is the actual data. And we also have some holes. So in this setup, all this stuff here, this is loaded from the executable. And the heap and the stack are created when the executable runs. The stack is created when the executable runs push and pop and call and return instructions. That's what writes the stack. The heap is created when we call malloc or new or similar functions. So that's what makes the heap be allocated. But we have this initial piece, which is loaded from the executable, which is this code and constant, so the actual machine code, and the initial values of our global variables, which is our writable data. And on Linux, the convention is that they're laid out like this, that we, by default, choose a fixed address that might be changeable for where the code and data go. We put the heap after that. We put the stack near the top. And we have this region at the top of memory, which is used by the OS internally. And we have a bunch of holes in here. So any questions about this layout? So the first thing we're going to explore is, well, we know that this is what the layout looks like. I told you that this section gets loaded from the executable. So how do we actually get from our compiler, you know, our C program, to the stuff that's loaded from the executable? And we have these steps that you've probably vaguely seen before from 2150. So first, we take our C code and compile it into assembly. And then we run it through the assembler. But the assembler doesn't turn it into our executable yet. We turn it into something known as an object file. So the object file contains machine code, but it's not the executable. So something is missing. In particular, there's something which is missing here from that C file, which we'll need later on to make an executable. Can someone tell me, like, what things might that C file, you know, not be in the C file that we need to turn it into an executable? Yeah?
Would it be standard
IO? So standard IO.h. So yeah, so there's something about standard IO.h. So there's something more precise than that. So when we compile this file, the C compiler loads standard IO.h. But the question is, what's in there? And it has a declaration for printf that's going to look something like this. Int printf care star dot 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 semicolon. But that's typically all it has. It just has a declaration for printf. So what we're missing is the code that implements that. So the compiler loaded the code for standard IO.h, which wasn't in this file, but it doesn't actually include the definition. And that, because it's not in the assembly, so there's no printf here, and there's no printf in the object file, because the assembler is just going to take the assembly instructions, turn it into machine code. It's not going to fix that problem. So our object file is missing the implementation of printf. And what our compiler does is we have this last linking step where the compiler is going to find the implementation of printf and add that with our actual main code and produce the executable that we can actually load and run. Because when we load it into memory, it better be the case that this code in constants has a copy of printf in here somewhere. Or else, how do we run it? There's no place in memory where we can find printf. So, any questions about this idea? Yes?
So if we were to write in printf like the exact same header in our code, but not write include standard.io.h, would it link that for us anyway? Or
the question,
do we have to have that to get it linked?
So the question is, does including standard.io.h make sure the linking happens? And the answer is, no. So the way GCC works is that when you, in most compilers, when you ask to produce an executable, unless you explicitly say not to, they will always link the C library into that executable,
Okay. Which
includes functions like printf. And if there's any conditionality about what gets linked in, it's going to be based on what functions are actually referenced or not. So if you don't want to have printf included from the C library and you call it, you have to explicitly tell the compiler, no, I have my own, or something like that.
So why do we get an error when we don't include standard IO then?
So why do you get an error?
Yeah,
so
if it gets linked anyway.
So if you had the correct declarations, you would not get an error.
Okay.
But you do need to declare the function. And this is something which is happening not down over here in the linking step, but in this compiling step. The compiler is deciding, do I know about this function without regard to whether it's going to be able to put it in your executable yet.
Okay.
And when you use GCC, I guess I showed you each of these steps. Commonly, you don't do the steps individually of assembling, then producing the object file and linking. Often you do commands which do multiple steps. So GCC minus C, if you give it a .c file, it produces an object file. It does the assembling step, it just doesn't show you the output of the before the assembler run. It just runs both and discards the intermediate file. If you ask to produce an executable from a .c file, it produces all these the assembly file and the .o file, but it just gets rid of them when it's done rather than keeping a copy around. Okay, so see, I guess I have. So let's talk about more detail about what's in those files. So we talked about what was missing from the object file that were produced, why that's not an executable. Let's talk more about what happens. So we compile, say, our hello.c here, and we get assembly which looks something like this. I've just stripped out some extra stuff. I'm showing this assembly in AT&T syntax. The reason I'm doing that is our textbook and some tools we'll be using later on use it in Intel syntax. The biggest difference is that the order of the operands is basically always destination last. So the subtract goes into RSP. So in Intel syntax, subtract into RSP of 8. Here it's subtract 8 from RSP. The same thing there. So we have our assembly here, and this is going to get converted to an object file. And when we do that, we're going to take these assembly instructions and write out the machine code for that. And we actually have two pieces here. We have this text segment, which you vaguely remember from 2050, which is where the code is. So you just write out the machine code, and I promise you this is machine code corresponding to these instructions. And we have the data segment, where we write out the data segment. In this case, those are the bytes corresponding to the string hello world. I'm showing you this in a readable way. In the real file, we're probably going to not like write it in hex. And this corresponds to, we have pieces which correspond like so to what's in the assembly file.
Okay.
And something we'll talk about next time is, well, I have this call to put S. I don't know where that goes, so I'm going to leave a placeholder. And we're going to talk about how that's fixed up next time. And that's what linking is that we don't know where put S is and things like that. How do we make that work in our final executable?